Welcome to Collaboracast. I'm one half of your host, Ben Leroy, and with me, as always, the wonderful Jason Buckles.
Hey, Ben. Good to be here, as always. This week, we have an interview with my friend, Kat Poster. As you'll hear, Kat and her family fled Ukraine in 1989. They were fleeing Soviet-occupied Ukraine. And her story is, I'd heard bits of it before, I heard pieces of it, but this was the first time that I'd really sat down and spoken to her about it at length. And it was hard for me to keep it together. It's really powerful. I think that it portrays how this experience, how the ramifications of what is happening in that part of the world now, how these things will last for decades, how the sheer amount of trauma that is being created and sent out into the world by this single decision is going to be decades and decades in the making.
Kat talks about the idea of community and how we, well, in this case, Kat, but so many people are forced to leave their community. And it isn't simply by virtue of being somewhere else that you become part of a new community. And the challenges there are with leaving behind everything you know to be somewhere else. And how do you find the same level of acceptance and comfort in a new place? How much can we rely on existing communities to welcome refugees and make them feel at home and make them feel a part of something? It would be not unusual to still mean well for somebody, but not provide them with everything that you could.
I think that her story really portrays the changes in the relationship to that. On the morning that I interviewed her, I woke up, took a look at the news, and the first thing that I saw was that count had surpassed 1 million refugees. Each one of these is a story of a shattered sense of community and what is in many cases going to be a lifelong attempt to try to rediscover and rebuild that. And so many of us take that for granted. I currently live about 50 minutes from where I grew up. Last summer, I had a reunion with a couple dozen people that I met in junior high. You know, this is when I was 12. I have the great luxury and privilege of being in the middle of this lifelong community. For so many people, it's a very different experience, and one decision by one madman has now completely destroyed that sense, that right, that privilege for millions of people so far, and, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, to come. And one of the things that we can do is we can help. We can help with donations. And so we wanted to do our part to be able to do something about this. So the International Rescue Committee is an organization who was on the ground in Poland supporting displaced children and families with vital supplies. Here, I'm reading off their website. They're asking for donations to help them with this refugee crisis.
If you would like to donate to the International Rescue Committee, we would like to, in turn, edit the first pages of your manuscript in progress at a rate of $1 per page, maximum 50 pages. If you're interested in this, please send an email to info@collaborist.org.
Make that donation directly to them. And then you just let us know, and we would be more than happy to lend our expertise to your manuscript in exchange for that. Thank you in advance, and please help if you can.
And now let's listen to Jason speaking with Kat Poster.
Woke up this morning, the first thing that I did was to look at my newsfeed, and the article was about the fact that we've now reached over 1 million refugees from Ukraine. And the world's attention is on this, but it's not a new story. So I wanted to talk to you and pull the lens back a little bit. Where were you born, and where did you spend the first years of your life?
Yeah, I was born in Odessa, which is a city in the Ukraine of a little over 1 million people on the Black Sea. I was born in 1980, and our family immigrated to the U.S. in 1989.
So this was during the Soviet occupation. What were those early days like? So what are your memories of those first 9 or 10 years there? What did your parents do? What was it like? I'm sure there were your experiences of your family, but then what do you remember about the relationship between what was then a somewhat autonomous political entity but then also a part of the Soviet Union? How did that affect you? What do you remember of that?
Yeah, I think as a kid, your perception is, of course, different and less broad than that of an adult. But I grew up in communism and in the USSR. And actually, when I first get married, my husband and I had a long discussion about this. I was under the impression growing up that the USSR won the Cold War. That's what we were told. And that's why I guess everything was so great. I had a really great childhood from so many different perspectives, in that when you grow up in communism, the one thing you have in common is no one has anything, except what you do have is you have your humanity, you have your human relations. So it's a system that relies on relationships, on a system of favors, and just on the human heart. And actually really loved growing up in that way. I mean, paying for childcare would be unheard of in that system. And when a neighbor was sick, the entire building banded together to support that person. So from a human perspective, it was really beautiful. But there was no opportunity. The level of education was phenomenal. My mom is has a master's in thermophysics and nuclear dynamics, and my dad is an accountant. My dad's a CPA, but you couldn't apply that skill set really for your own stability or enrichment. It was a very strange system.
So those were credentials. Those were levels of education that they attained there. So they were having a different experience. For you, there was unity and community. They made a pretty big decision when you were about 9 or 10. What were the factors that went into the decision that they made?
Yeah. Ultimately, I think human character and human greed on some level prevails. So when communism started loosing its grasp, entrepreneurial people started kind of to branch out. So my father actually had the first for-profit, that was called a cooperative at the time, but a for-profit enterprise little store, similar to like a hardware store in our city. And of course, as in any corrupt system, my dad had to pay to a mafia of sorts for protection. And one day my dad was at work, and this other crew showed up and said, well, you're now paying us. You're no longer paying this other entity. And my dad said, okay, but why am I paying this other entity if you can just come in here and show up and demand money? And they said, yeah, that's all very interesting, except we know your daughter takes art classes and walks by herself every Wednesday between 4 and 6 p.m. on the following street. And my parents were ostensibly pretty happy individuals, made the very hard decision in their late 30s to uproot their life in order to ensure my safety and prosperity.
Do you remember the moment that you left, or the moment that they told you that was happening, like leaving the home that you had known and were where you were happy?
We ran in the middle of the night on a bus, on a chartered bus. It was three and us and three other families that chartered a bus. You weren't allowed to legally leave the country. We left on the bus, ultimately ended up in Austria, where there was humanitarian aid from various European and US entities. We stayed for a number of months in Austria, after which we went to Italy, stayed for some time there, and finally made our way to the US. All of that time, I mean, we had no money, so we relied on on humanitarian aid.
That night you departed, what do you remember of that? How do you remember feeling? Who were you leaving behind? What was your understanding of what was happening?
Very limited. My parents really tried to shield me for what's to come. I was not fully conscious of what that journey was going to be. We left everything. Everything was left. I mean, no one owned property. So you basically leave your apartment, you take your clothes, you take, a couple of stuffed animals and a few books, and you leave. And those are your belongings.
I imagine that they probably didn't really know what the journey was going to entail either. So even if they'd wanted to prepare you, they probably wouldn't have been able to.
100%. And I remember my mom was not ready to leave. My mom was a professor at the university at the time. My dad, of course, was this entrepreneur. And I remember when my dad came and told my mom that we had to move, my mom said no. And there was a lot to overcome with her. So now we're on this bus with these crying women, these children who they don't know what's going on, and these men in their early 30s who were kind of supporting this entourage of weepers. I remember that. Yeah.
Who did you leave behind? Did you have cousins, neighbors, friends? How much time did you have to prepare for this? I mean, was this kind of pack your stuff? We're going right now, or?
No, I think my parents prepared. It took time to charter buses and pack all your stuff and give things away. But what I do remember, it was probably 3 a.m. when it was time to board the bus and leave. And there were probably 50 people waiting outside to say goodbye. My parents, best friends, because in those days, you didn't know if you'd ever see each other again.
So this particular bus had three families on it, but it sounds like this was something that was happening, that was beginning to happen. There were bus operators who were doing this and had ways of getting across the border, ways of getting beyond the Iron Curtain.
Yeah. We were part of a wave of immigrants who were leaving for religious and political reasons.
Because of the tightening grip. I mean, you mentioned the it sounds like there was some tension between your dad being able to be an entrepreneur and then other entities deciding that they didn't really like that very much. I imagine that there was increasing tension around those things. This was as the Berlin Wall was falling, right? And just a couple of years before the Soviet Union dissolved.
There was no opportunity. It is, I think we live now in the US, we live in a country where we discuss and we entertain different political systems. In reality, unless you've lived through communism, you can glorify it. But it's a very difficult system for people, because it's actually against kind of human characteristics of wanting to be an achiever, wanting to be recognized for your achievements, being able to use your education, not being afraid of the police, not being afraid that one day you're gonna, you'll be evicted. It'd be nice to own property. It'd be nice to own a car. None of that's possible in communism.
So you made it to Austria. What took you to Italy? Do you remember how, the first goal is to get out of Ukraine.
Yeah.
And then you get to Austria. And then how did you, what were the kind of the signposts that took you to Italy? And then what did you find when you got there?
This was a route that was crafted by waves of immigrants before us. So my dad's sister actually immigrated exactly 10 years before us in the late 70s. And she was already in San Francisco, but it was the same route that we followed. So there were some of these systems that were already established by previous waves of migration. So we were kind of swept up in this kind of late 80s, early 90s wave. And we were really the last wave of former USSR residents that came over through that.
Just a little bit like the Underground Railroad, kind of a network of people along the way to help and direct you.
Yeah. Or like the Oregon Trail. It depends. Yeah.
Pick your analogy. So in Italy, what did you find there? You kind of regrouped with a lot of other migrants at that point, right?
We did. And when we first arrived, we were taken to a kind of a facility. It was in the winter, but it became very clear that this was where I think the poor Italians might vacation in the summer. It had these like makeshift huts, which some migrants actually used as permanent shelters. We stayed there for a couple of days and my mom was like, no way, I can't live here. So they went out and started in their terrible broken Italian, they learned like three phrases. They started to look for an apartment. So we were able to rent an apartment in Italy in one of the sleepy coastal towns outside of Rome. It's very dense in the summers and hardly anyone there in the winter. And I have to say the attitude and the demeanor and the graciousness of Italian people was just overwhelming. When they saw families like ours, there was hardly anyone who didn't stop. There was hardly anyone who didn't offer money, appliances. People brought washers and dryers. They brought TV. They brought food. They brought toys for me. And these weren't hand-me-downs. This was all, functioning new stuff. We were blown away by the kindness of people.
Hmm. And there was some community there, right? Your mom found work, a little bit of a demotion, right? But she...
My mom applied all of her skills to get a job as a dishwasher at an Italian restaurant and quickly realized that she, in fact, doesn't know how to wash dishes. But there were other migrants from other Eastern European countries who also, either swept floors or waited tables at this restaurant. So the compromise they struck is they would wash dishes while my mom read them Russian classics. Russian was the one language that everyone had in common at the time because of, how vast the empire laid its claws.
So these were refugees from all over the former, all the different republics, and then this place in Italy collected them, I would imagine, in part because of the kindness of the people there and the openness and their willingness to help. And then what happened? How did you get here to Northern California, where you and I both live?
My dad's sister, who was already here, applied for family reconciliation. And that's how we were able to make it here. So we came as legal immigrants. And then a few years had to pass before we were able to get green cards.
How long was it before, so you left Ukraine in 1989, how many years was it that took you through Austria and into Italy before you were able to come here?
It varied for different people. There wasn't a kind of a set amount of time, for some months, for some years. really depended on what this kind of family reconciliation paperwork looked like and how willing the U.S. was to admit you.
For you personally, how long was that phase of your life?
Ours in Italy was under a year, so we got very lucky.
What did you do in that time? So you're 9, 10 years old?
Yeah.
Don't imagine you were in school?
No, I wasn't in school. but, you know, given my parents' level of education, just the emphasis on education, that's cultural. My parents studied with me every day. But I think we played a lot of cards. We walked on the beach. Remember, there was a lot of shell collecting. There were other kids that came by. We played soccer. We played other games.
Russian literature.
Yeah, but honestly, I just remember it as such a bright time in my life because I, you know, as a child, you have no sense of being poor. Like, I had no idea we were poor. We sold things on the side of the street to cars that would sometimes stop and sometimes buy, you know, little tchotchkes. And I just loved it.
Things you would find, things like...
Things that people, you know, in other countries perceive are, you know, are cultural things that we would use, which we would never use. They're like that we brought with us because we heard from immigrants prior that Italians would pay for these things, like decorative spoons and other things, rugs, little rugs.
The import-export business.
Yeah, I just thought it was normal to sell things on the side of the street.
So a year or so, and then you land in San Francisco. And how much English do you speak at this point?
Yeah, I speak zero English at this point.
And you're plunked into a San Francisco public school. And what grade?
Yeah, I'm in fourth grade. My parents walk me into a San Francisco public school. And I'm in shock because I have never seen people who don't look like me. And I see Asians, I see African Americans, Latin people, and it's just, it's mind blowing. And my parents just dropped me off and said, see you later.
And you had your work cut out for you.
It was a challenging time.
A little bit of an understatement.
Yeah, that's tough.
Tell me a little bit about the history of your name. I know you as Cat Poster. But yeah. That's not what you were born as.
So I am ethnically Russian, but raised in the Ukraine. So my sympathies and, you know, my allegiance is with the Ukrainian people. My first name, of course, is Katya. And my last name is Rizhaya, which means redhead. Which I assume some grandma in some village was redheaded and at some point, and that's where the last name came from.
And you're blonde.
And I'm fake blonde.
One of my favorite bands is Blonde Redhead. So yeah. I think you're the embodiment. Where do you feel like you belong now? You've got a family, you've lived here for over 3 decades, we've had conversations before about our respective senses of otherness. How does that work for you in your family, your community, your neighborhood, your town, the Bay Area?
Yeah. Well, I've had to be completely frank. I don't feel like I belong anywhere. The only place I ever feel that I belong is in my house with my family. But I do not have a physical affiliation to a place. So I've been in the Bay Area on and off since basically 1990, right? I can't say though that I've ever truly assimilated. I've always felt out of place. And if a sense of place is mental, then in my house is the only time I'm ever fully comfortable. And I've been back to visit my city in the Ukraine, and I definitely don't belong there. But I also don't feel like I belong here. One of the things being, and you and I talk about this, and I've mentioned this, one of my biggest takeaways from communism was the people relationships, that there was this reliance and this love and this network. And I just feel like in the US, it's a little bit more transactional. And that's not who I am, but I'm also not a person from that other place. So no, does that answer your question?
It does. It does. And you have kids now who are about the age that you were when you left Ukraine. And I was thinking that it must be striking to you to see how much things have changed. The decision that your parents made created such a massive difference two generations later for what are now your kids. You must be looking at what's going on now and thinking about 9-year-olds who are fleeing Ukraine today. And I'm wondering if, to me, it seems like I'm struck by how such a difference and how the differences and the similarities can coexist. And I wonder if you had thoughts about your own kids, how different their experience is than yours.
My kids feel to me a lot more immature and younger than I've ever felt at that age. For example, obviously, you know, I didn't speak English. I didn't fit in. I didn't have any cool clothes. So I had a really hard time fitting in at school when I came. But I never told my parents this. And I knew it was much harder for my parents. So the only time I had to myself, which was at night, I would just lie in bed crying. But I never allowed my parents to see me cry or to see me suffer, because I knew for them it was infinitely harder. I don't think my kids would extend to me the same courtesy, because now my kids just bring all of their minutia home and I have to sort through it, because they're so lucky. They're so advantaged.
It's a luxury that they get to be immature. They get to be kids. They don't have to carry such things around.
I'm grateful to my parents that I'm able to provide to my children that security.
When you look at what's going on, is there, I think re-traumatizing might be maybe too strong of a word, you know, knowing you and knowing what your experiences have been, but knowing your story, knowing that this was a generation ago and seeing that this is continued, like despite the 30 years in between where things have been relatively peaceful, at least in this respect, it seems the way that history is repeating itself. I'm just wondering if you have thoughts about that and about whether or not we're making any progress in this world towards anything at all, or if this is just, if we're just on hamster wheels.
Oh man, it's such a big question. Yeah, do I have PTSD? Absolutely. I have had this was so unexpected. And I think this was so unexpected to everybody that I'm still in a state of shock. So I am so deeply saddened. And at the same time, I have the highest level of fear and anxiety that I've ever felt, because we're dealing with a person who is mentally unstable and has a nuclear arsenal at his fingertips. I mean, that is a scary combination.
And your parents have relatives, friends who are there.
Yeah. And we have friends and relatives in Moscow and Russia as well. So here's what we understand of the situation. In the Ukraine, it's pretty dire. So even the cities that are not getting bombed, there are no resources. There's no food in stores. There's no gas in gas stations. You can't get on a flight anywhere. All the schools are closed. We have a friend who has a couple of dogs, and she's unable to get dog food. So those are the people who are not getting, whose homes are not getting destroyed. In Moscow, these are people who did not want war, who've actually benefited from the Westernization of Moscow and the fact that Western countries wanted to do business there. These are my business school friends who went to, you know, a top 10 business school in the US, who are, you know, real contributors to society. And the situation is they've lost their savings. They've lost their jobs. They can't get out of the country. They're hated uniformly by everyone. And they're afraid for the safety of their children because insane radicals in full army militia are walking outside of their doors.
This is in Moscow. These are Russians. These are
Russians.
Do you have a sense of, there's been a lot of conversation about the disinformation that Putin has spread and attempts to try to counter that in various ways. Do you have any kind of sense of, with your connections there and your insights there, if the experience that they're having and their disillusionment with the narrative that Putin has provided, do you have a sense of how widespread that is, of what the understanding there in Moscow is about what's happening versus what he's saying, you know, the reasons that he did this?
I mean, Moscow is a wealthy city, right? So people there, at least the intelligentsia, the educated people, never held Putin in any kind of regard. So there's not a disillusionment. They benefit from everything Western. I know he has a stronghold on a generation that's, you know, my parents, my grandparents, the older generation, who were taught to hate the West. I mean, imagine, I grew up thinking that the USSR won the Cold War. And we're from an educated family. So the propaganda machine is very effective there.
And that would be a victory of almost an ideology as well. I would imagine that the story that goes along with that is that the Soviets won the Cold War because the ideologies were superior, the way of life was superior. And that's, if you believe that at that age, that becomes a pretty hard story to get out of your system.
That's true. I mean, think about what we were told, that the West is undisciplined, that the only thing the West cares about is money. You know, and here we are, and, you know, we're so much smarter, and we're so much more resilient and tougher and all these things, with the right set of values. And of course, they have the wrong set of values. And if that is drilled into you every single day, how can you, you know, not resent the fat pig?
Gaslighting. It's gaslighting on the most colossal scale imaginable.
Yeah, I think politicians everywhere utilize, you know, some form of that. Putin to an extreme, of course, but he does have, or had, I would say, a stronghold on that slice of the population.
Do you think that this decision is weakening that stronghold?
I pray every minute of every day for the past week that yes. But it's unclear. I have no idea what they're thinking, what they're hearing. I just hope that some combination of sanctions and support for the counter effort bankrupt him. I'm just very fearful that I don't want to see what this kind of a guy does when his back is against the wall, because he does not back down. That scares me.
Me too. And I've been saying those same prayers.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your time and your story with me.
Thanks, Jason. Always a pleasure.
Again, we would like to support the efforts that the International Rescue Committee is putting forth on the ground in Poland to support the refugees who are coming in. So we will edit your manuscript at the rate of one page per dollar that you donate to the International Rescue Committee. send an email to info@collaboris.org for more information. And that would just a minimum of $25 and a maximum of $50. So if you can help, please do. Ben, what else is happening in Collaborist land?
We still have an offer out that people, if you have questions about the publishing industry, writing, craft, etc., what Collaborist does, please send those to info@collaborist.org. And next episode, we will be answering all of the questions that have come in and will continue to come in. Also, be sure to visit our website and look. The groups are filling up. They are underneath the community tab. There are lots of opportunities for online writers groups across a variety of genres and skill levels. We will begin those in late March, and availability is getting limited in some of those. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe and like and leave a review wherever you do that, and find us on social media, all of the regular social medias. And that's pretty much it from here, dude.
For story.
For community.
Collaborist.
Someday we'll get it right.